Hello and welcome to EDUCAUSE Now. I'm Jerry Bain.
And I'm Colleen Luckett.
Well, Colleen, it seems we've come to a fork in the road.
I think so. This will be my last EDUCAUSE Now with you. I'm moving on to other endeavors and adventures.
Well, as you look toward the future of Colleen, we'll be looking at the future of higher education on this episode of EDUCAUSE Now.
Indeed. To coincide with the release of a new white paper on the future of higher ed, we'll present a conversation with three university leaders on this very topic.
Students are far more demanding these days in terms of a whole range of things than I think they were 20 years ago.
But I think they're also less demanding in a different way.
And we'll also share some thoughts from the recent Coalition for Networked Information 2009 Fall Task Force meeting. If you'd like to find out more about the stories and ideas you hear on EDUCAUSE Now, please visit our show notes at www.educause.edu/now.
The term high-performance computing is often used interchangeably with supercomputing, and it refers to a type of very fast computer, capable of performing calculations many times faster than the standard desktop machine. And high-performance computing, or HPC, has had a dramatic impact on scientific research, leading to new ways of doing research that just wasn't possible before. And we're talking about not just more efficient research, but a real paradigm shift for sciences like meteorology and astronomy. The data processing is so fast that researchers can run incredibly complex simulations, like crash tests, explosions, or even whole weather systems. But one area HPC has not touched is the humanities. Could supercomputing benefit research in the field of the humanities? Brett Bobley is Chief Information Officer and Director of the Digital Humanities Initiative for the National Endowment for the Humanities. He speaks with a lot of enthusiasm about the unlikely partnership his organization formed with the Department of Energy. What happened was this. The DOE, who's been on the leading edge of developing these high-powered computers, noticed that humanities researchers hadn't been introduced to supercomputing, and they wondered if it could be an advantage in that field.
And the Department of Energy is very excited about this, and they were, however, concerned about the fact that they didn't see humanities researchers taking advantage of these machines the way the scientists were. So they approached us and they said, look, you know, we are investing in these machines it's with taxpayer resources, and we want these to be available to scholars and scientists across all the disciplines, not just the scientists. And they hope that the National Endowment for the Humanities, with our connections to the humanities research world, could help bridge that kind of cultural gap to get humanities researchers more aware of the power of supercomputing and try to see if we can get those cultures talking to each other.
But just because you have a tool doesn't mean you know how to use it. The HPC experts had to learn some of the culture of the humanities researchers, as the humanities researchers learned what supercomputing could do for them. The question was how to create a bridge between these two cultures.
So in working with the Department of Energy, we decided that it would be great to put together a program that enabled these first steps to take place, to really let some humanities scholars get their feet wet, experiment with the supercomputers, and at the same time allow the Department of Energy supercomputing staffs to become more familiar with what kind of work we do in the humanities, so that these two cultures can start to talk to each other and over time start to work together and perhaps accomplish some of these similar breakthroughs in the humanities that we've seen in the sciences.
And that's what led to the current project, the HHPC program.
That's an acronym that we coined. It stands for Humanities High Performance Computing. So the Department of Energy and the NEH got together and we kind of brainstormed, and we actually consulted with a lot of people in the field. So we put together this grant competition called HHPC, Humanities High Performance Computing. And in a nutshell, what the winners of this competition would win, in a sense, is two things. You would get time on a supercomputer, which in and of itself, I should note, is quite valuable. Scientists have to go through a peer review process just to get time on these machines, because these machines literally cost hundreds of millions of dollars. It's not like they're sitting around waiting for people to use them. It is a competitive process to get time to use them. The second thing they would receive is in-depth training, and that's really the key here. So the Department of Energy they basically donated to this program 1 million hours. They said that they would divide up 1 million hours on their supercomputers to humanities researchers. The second thing they contributed is their staff to provide training. In particular, they have a facility in Berkeley, California called NERSC. And NERSC they have a large staff of supercomputing engineers, trainers, scientists, all kinds of people. And they agreed that the winners of this competition would get to go to NERSC for about a week and do some in-depth training. And that even once that training was over, to continue to work via email with the humanities researchers so they can help develop their projects and get them in working.
For the NEH's part, they conducted the competition and provided the winning researchers with money to travel to Berkeley for training and computer time. And at the end of the competition, there were three projects chosen. The first was the Perseus Digital Library. The Perseus Project, as it's known, is out of Tufts University.
What they're going to be doing is using the NERSC systems, the supercomputers, to help them measure how the meanings of words in Latin and Greek have changed over thousands of years. So they will actually be doing some advanced computational linguistics work where they're analyzing thousands of Greek and Latin texts and seeing how the words changed over time and also changed in translation as they were translated over time into different languages. This is an area, of course, that classicists have always pursued, but it's incredibly time-consuming. And in fact, the folks at the Perseus Project have been doing this type of work on desktop machines for years and have found it's incredibly slow to do.
And that's one of the things high-performance computing allows researchers to do, is more iterative work. For instance, if you have a linguistics algorithm that breaks down and compares large batches of text, it may take weeks to run on a desktop computer, not something you can tweak as you run it over and over. But these machines allow researchers to get results almost instantly and tweak their algorithms in a way they never could before.
The second folks are from the University of Virginia, specifically Mr. David Kohler. David Kohler is a computer scientist who actually works in the classics department at the University of Virginia. He is someone who is a kind of a pioneer in 3D modeling of ancient statues and historical artifacts. But one of the things that David tells us is that when he does laser scanning of artifacts, for example, he did a laser scan of Michelangelo's famous statue of David in Rome, where they literally put up scaffolding and carefully laser scan every inch of the statue to create a 3D version of it. But that creates billions and billions of data points. In fact, so many data points that he is unable to render that information into 3D on the computers available to him at the University of Virginia. And in fact, if you look at the 3D version of the Statue of David, he had to do a low-resolution version of it because he did not have the processing power locally to do that kind of 3D rendering. So this is an example where supercomputing will enable him and his colleagues at the University of Virginia to do work that they simply could not do before. Another thing that David Kohler is working on, which is really quite interesting, is taking archaeological fragments. These are pieces of, for example, a stone tablet that were smashed thousands of years ago. And archaeologists are trying to fit them back together like a puzzle. But if there are literally thousands of pieces, that can be incredibly difficult to do. So one project they're working on is to create a 3D laser scan of each piece, and then using a supercomputer to computationally attempt to fit the puzzle back together again. Something that would be incredibly difficult for a human to do manually, but they're hoping that this may solve problems that archaeologists have faced for thousands of years, or hundreds of years, I should say, and put these pieces back together.
The third winner was the University of California, San Diego, for its project on visualizing patterns and databases of cultural images and video. UC San Diego has been creating computerized visualizations of large databases of digitized cultural heritage materials and using HPC to perform statistical analyses on the data to discover new ways of studying art and culture. So there you have it, a new partnership between high-performance computing and the humanities, a partnership that's growing. The Institute for Computing and Humanities, Arts, and Social Science, or IHAS, and the National Institute for Computational Sciences at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, recently announced that they are making available 2 million additional hours of supercomputing time for projects in the humanities, arts, and social sciences. If you'd like to find out more about high-performance computing in the humanities, visit our show notes at www.educause.edu/now. Higher education's purpose is to equip students for success in life, in the workplace, in communities, and in their personal lives. And while this purpose has remained constant for centuries, the world around colleges and universities has undergone dramatic changes. At last year's EDUCAUSE annual conference, I sat down with three university leaders to discuss the future of higher education. Joel Smith is the Vice Provost and CIO at Carnegie Mellon University, Tracy Futhi is the Vice President and CIO at Duke University, and Rick Luce is Vice Provost and Director of the University Libraries at Emory University. I started by asking what they thought are some of the drivers of change in higher education.
There are any number of drivers that affect all of us. It's obvious that the sort of accountability to the public and the cost of education is a huge driver, and recently the economic situation makes that even more evident.
Tracy Futhi.
For us in the IT world, the pace of technology change is a huge issue, and tagged right along with that, I would say, is the consumerization of technologies and the complexity of our jobs now being much less about deciding on a technology and bringing it to our campus and much more about contending with technologies that people have been using for 10 or 15 years. Tied to that, you know, sort of technology churn and change is the notion that the internet has created some perceptions that everything's free, and in some ways it almost is, right? So I think that's a whole lot of pressure on the universities and a very different environment than the one even a decade ago, let alone a century ago.
Just to add a few more drivers in there from my perspective.
Rick Luce.
I mean, we live in a global world, and so increasingly, not just the number of international students, but we live in a very competitive environment, far more competitive than we used to. That's a driver. The expectations of students, I think, in terms of what they're going to tangibly get out of their experience is significantly different than it was 20, 30 years ago. And much less, unfortunately, in my view, but much less about coming out more educated and knowledgeable about the world around us, and instead with an expectation about specific skills and where those would fit in the workforce. We're living in a time where knowledge is doubling. It used to be every 7 years. Now in some of the sciences are beginning to say every about 3.5 years.
I thought it was every 7 minutes.
Every 7 minutes. It wouldn't surprise me. And all of that in many ways then gets, if you think about a value chain, what's coming out of this enormous engine called higher education and the research going on in higher education is enormous changes in terms of scholarly communication, how we communicate the results of what we're doing.
So I would add that on the research side, there's actually an increasing dependence on our universities to do the research that is essential for the future of the nation.
Joel Smith.
This has happened slowly, but if you think of things like Xerox PARC scaling down, virtually disappearing, you think of Bell Labs virtually disappearing, I mean, the dependence that we have on the research that goes on at the universities is much greater than Vannevar Bush might have imagined when he first said, you know, we've really got to start to fund this. And that's become a much more complex relationship between industry, the governments, and universities. And I think that's driving change in the way that we do research. I'll add one other thing, which I think, you know, that we are all concerned about, and that is the need for access. I mean, there literally were hundreds of thousands of students turned away from universities this year, not because they didn't have the qualifications to get in, but because we just couldn't provide the resources to actually educate them. And that's in the U.S., and you scale that globally, then, you know, it's something that we have to think about when we think about the future. I think that's going to be a very powerful driver.
Mm-hmm. Are the demands of students changing? You said something about education being more sort of job-oriented, more industry-oriented. What's the changing demands of students these days?
Well, I think that's a great point, and I'll just add to it, is not necessarily in a positive way. I mean, we deal with consumer students. Mm-hmm. We deal with students who expect a climbing wall to be available in the gym. We certainly have huge expectations around the information technology that we will provide to them, right? And you know, we are facing some real questions about, you know, how much we can really afford to meet the consumer demands and whether we're going to get into a kind of competition about what we provide, you know, outside of the learning experiences. So absolutely, students are far more demanding these days in terms of a whole range of things than I think they were 20 years ago.
But I think they're also less demanding in a different way, right? They're so used to dealing with technology that sometimes through their last 15 years, they experiment with it. It's not fully baked. That's okay, right? You know, oh, that link didn't work. That's okay. I mean, in that way, they're more forgiving, right? So it's an interesting dichotomy of, on one hand, this, you know, consumer and consumption and customer view and how they interact with us. But on the other hand, this willingness to say, oh, it's not a big deal. I'll try it tomorrow and see if it works tomorrow. So really a little schizophrenic in terms of us on the IT side trying to understand how do we deliver the environment thereafter. Can we even put our finger on what that environment should be?
To take that just a little bit further, there is both a consumer sort of mindset. I see this new tool in Google. It was released a month ago. Why isn't it on my iPhone in the university? But the flip side of that is not just the willingness to settle for some things are broken, but in many cases, a lack of really the critical thinking skills to evaluate where things come from, how solid is it, et cetera. And so that creates a real one could look at it as a burden or as an opportunity, but a real need for us to really fill that gap in.
Yeah, I think that's a gap we have in terms of teaching information literacy, right? I mean, throughout the curriculum is new, you know, because of the access to very different kinds of information. And I think there's also this element of they're actually fairly good at learning, but, you know, sort of learning how they learn, right, is something that they're going to really have because it doesn't stop, right? They're going to have to retool almost immediately on graduating, in part because of that doubling of knowledge. And so focusing on information literacy and focusing on teaching metacognition, helping them learn how they learn best, and that's going to vary, you know, for individuals, is I think something we're going to have to build more into the curriculum.
Joel Smith, Tracy Futhi, and Rick Luce. Talking about the future of higher education. This entire conversation is much longer and goes much more in depth, so stay tuned for future podcasts as we release more of the conversation in the coming weeks in both video and audio formats. You can find the new white paper on the future of higher education by searching for the future of higher education on the EDUCAUSE website.
Thanks for joining us.
And thank you for joining us, Colleen. You were a great co-host, and you will be missed, not just by me, but I'm sure by at least three listeners.
Well, thank you, Jerry. I appreciate that. It was a pleasure.
If you have any thoughts or ideas you'd like to share about the podcast, you can write to me at podcast@educause.edu. Also, remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes by searching for EDUCAUSE or by visiting www.educause.edu/now. Thanks for listening.
Bye.